From Illinois to New Jersey, Missouri to Washington, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, David Bradford is a direct descendant of William Bradford, the first governor of the Plymouth Colony, set up when the Pilgrims landed in America. He is here to talk about the principles of self-government they established. Congress faces a mid-December deadline to pass the remainder of the nation's fiscal year budget. Look for another massive omnibus spending bill. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. A new at-home COVID-19 test is about to become available, but as usual, there will be cumbersome government regulations. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine will get details from Jeffrey Singer of the Cato Institute. And more is at stake in those Senate runoff elections in Georgia than the two seats in the U.S. Senate. They will decide whether the left has unfettered control of the federal government. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. When the Pilgrims first landed in America, they had to decide how to govern themselves. Thus, Plymouth Colony was built on a foundation of God-given equal rights. David Bradford is a direct descendant of William Bradford, who was the first governor of Plymouth Colony. He is here to talk about its enduring importance. David, welcome to American Radio Journal. David, it is now Thanksgiving time, and the reason why we celebrate this holiday, among others, is because the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock and formed the colony, the first colony here in America. William Bradford, you are a descendant of his, was the first governor of that colony. So tell us a little bit about why those first colonists came here and the principles upon which they set up that very first colony.
It's a great story of the Pilgrims' history, and unfortunately, too many people aren't really that well informed of it. I know growing up, I went to a very good school in Michigan, and I just learned basically two things about the Pilgrims. One, they escaped England to seek religious freedom, and then number two, they suffered a very difficult first winter and served as an inspiration to others, period. That was the extent of what we learned about the Pilgrims. And of course, Thanksgiving, the holiday that they celebrate, that's been an attempt to sort of link us back to our roots and what the Pilgrims were really about. And the thing that I think is so important for people to understand is that the Pilgrims were an extremely religiously motivated people. They became very renowned even in their lifetime, which I was surprised to learn, because I always thought that I always came later. They just were, you know, they wanted to get out of England and they were being persecuted and this sort of thing. But I also learned that they went to Holland for 12 years, which I thought they escaped England and came right to America. And what were they doing in Holland? You know, they had received and achieved their religious liberty by going to Holland. So why did they leave Holland? And so it just raised so many questions. And of course, being a direct descendant of Governor Bradford, I was very, very interested in learning more about what we know about the Pilgrims and what they were all about. And so it was very, very important to me to really look into what Bradford wrote. And I wanted to share his history in his own words. When you think about his diary, which is where we learn most of what we know about the early colony, his firsthand account, he and Governor Winslow, or Edward Winslow's accounts, are the basis of most firsthand information that we know. And one of the things that is so important for us to understand is that when he wrote this, he shared it as a historian, and he wrote in third person. And it was very hard, even me wanting to understand this, I found it very difficult to understand. It was only when I was able to sit down and I wanted to transcribe it in the first person, and I started taking his account and putting it into, instead of they and them, it was I and we, and I started sharing it as if I was William Bradford speaking, and it came alive, and it just became so powerful when you realize what he thought was important to share with other people. And he took the time to write it down and make sure he could pass that on to the next generation. I just felt an obligation to be the mouthpiece for Governor Bradford and be able to share his history, because it is so important to our foundation of our country. There's a direct connection between what the Pilgrims, they're like the seed or the DNA that was planted, that became and grew into the American, what it means to be an American.
Talk for a minute or so, if you will, about the principles that that colony was founded on and the principles that Governor Bradford and those early colonists established that ultimately became the bedrock for our entire national existence.
The basis and foundation of what they attempted to do was they were entirely intent on living out the New Testament church in their world. And they were committed to that fully, completely, 100%, their entire... They viewed the providence of God and what they should do, how they should live, was to model it after what the scripture says. And that's one of the things that most people have a hard time quite relating to, because they embodied faith. Like I said, they were renowned for it in their own time. So their foundation was to come here and to preach the gospel, basically, to the new world. That was one of their four motivations that Bradford actually wrote down. He actually enumerated them. He said, you know, when they left Holland, number one, number two, number three, and he said last but not least was the propagating of the gospel to the new world. So that was a very important foundational principle, was faith. And the other foundational principle was this idea of liberty and freedom. It was important that freedom was an individual liberty. It wasn't necessarily a group liberty, but each person was accountable to God and accountable to living out the life that God had placed before them. And that was a primary motivation for their colony, how they treated their neighbors. This wonderful relationship they had with the Wampanoag Indians is lost on most Americans. They figure, they're being told anyway today, that the Native American and indigenous people and the Pilgrims just came to wipe them out, steal their land, and genocide was their motivation. And that's not true at all. I mean, the treaty that they established in the first spring after they had arrived, when they first met the Poconocut tribe, it was a treaty that they entered into that lasted over half a century. And it's the only treaty that has survived the lifetime of the two primary people who entered into that agreement. That treaty lasted the lifetime of the Massasoit Assiniboine on the Poconocut side, and Bradford, Winslow, and Governor Carver. They all, it was over half a century, which is unique in American history.
Now, speaking of American history, unfortunately, a lot of it is not taught in public schools, and we've had various projects that have certainly distorted it. In an effort to set the record straight, you have established the 1620 experience. Tell us what that is and why it's important.
The 1620 experience is a series of episodes, 13 different episodes of 30 minutes apiece, that actually go into and teach the history of the Pilgrims and really brings the truth versus the sort of the lie that we're being exposed to today. And we're doing this in not just in a lecture format or a video format, but we're trying to make it a multi-platform, so it can be on social media. And these programs will be set up as webinars where people can attend, and we'll have video of showing and demonstrating and engaging people in the true history of the Pilgrims and this relationship with the Wampanoag Nation. And people can come and learn about it, but then also interact with myself and my son, who is also an educator and teaches this. So it's a wonderful platform for reaching out to that 12 to 25-year-old generation that really needs a good grounding and foundation in our American history, but also our founding history, which is the Pilgrim history that leads to the founding of our country.
And David, give us the website where folks can go to access the experience.
It's 1620experience.com. 1620, capital E-X, experience.com.
And we have been talking with David Bradford, a direct descendant of Governor William Bradford, who was one of the first individuals, along with a whole group of pilgrims, to land in this country and set up what ultimately became our national holiday that we're celebrating this week. And so we encourage you to go to the 1620experience.com. David Bradford. David, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Yes, we've been talking with Scott mainly about election matters for the past few weeks, but Congress is back in session and there is actual business to attend to. We're going to talk about that today. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman.
Congress coming back into session here after the holiday. We have an issue once again with the national budget, with December 11th being the end of the continuing resolution. So I want to bring our listeners up to speed, Scott, on where we stand with the federal budget and the possibility of yet another omnibus bill.
Yeah, well, here we are in the middle of November. Thanksgiving's coming up. Christmas is coming up. So what does that remind all your listeners of? The end of the year negotiations that always happen on Capitol Hill, and all the political theatrics that are associated with that. In September, President Trump signed legislation that funded the federal government through December 11th. And that always puts us in a difficult position when you're looking at the end of the year negotiations for federal spending, for different tax policies and tax extenders that are looking to be continued. And we knew that there would be a lame duck session of a Congress and potentially of a presidency, but it really puts all the dominoes in place to fall together to create a political momentum for something big to happen right before Christmas. And the December 11th date, they can obviously jump in at any time to change that. They could extend government funding at current levels to March, or they could send it to December 18th to give them another week to negotiate. But right now, we do look like we're on track for another one of those mega omnibus spending deals to come together in December.
In addition to the need for action to continue spending for the federal government, we have also had some posturing over the last week on another potential so-called stimulus bill in order to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, which by all accounts is getting dramatically worse in recent weeks. What are the possibilities, Scott, that Congress might get its act together to do something about a new stimulus bill before it has to adjourn?
I think any legislation that's huge in size and scope will probably be delayed into 2021 when you have a new Congress sworn into office. Republicans gain seats in the House, so they feel like they've got additional leverage. I know that Pelosi would like to get a deal done before January because she has more votes now and feels like she has more leverage in the negotiations than she will when it comes to the 117th Congress. Nonetheless, we're hearing about an extension of the Paycheck Protection Program. We're hearing about potential federal dollars to our education system in the states. And there could also be anomalies related to PPEs and health services. That's always been a really attractive bipartisan option in the negotiations. But meanwhile, I think you do need to understand that the economy is rebounded in a pretty strong fashion. We saw that economic data last month in October really pointing us toward a strong recovery. If it's a V-shaped recovery or a K-shaped recovery, I think is up for debate.
Ironically, Scott, President Trump, of course, with Operation Warp Speed, was able to empower the private sector to come up with these very effective vaccines in record time. And we are going to see over the next 4 to 8 weeks a significant rollout of the vaccine, probably initially to healthcare workers and first responders and then to the general population. So by the time we hit Inauguration Day in January, will we actually have hopefully rounded that bend the president's been talked about? But if things continue the way they have been, he'll be leaving office just as we're achieving success.
It's tough to say. I think that the American people have to decide if they want to be vaccinated. There is not going to be a mandate to be vaccinated. That would certainly create a lot of blowback among people that just don't really trust the information that's out there. And so as you begin to vaccinate the healthcare workers and first responders and the elderly population and the folks that are at risk, that's really who we've been trying to protect. We know that the actual death rate of people that are infected is incredibly low, but it's still a lot of people dying because the disease is so contagious. So that's why I think we've seen just so many cases every day, every week, every month, and the spike is happening. But once we've really got the vulnerable in the United States vaccinated, I do think that you'll see more of a return to normal behavior. Yeah, people will probably still be wearing masks. Yes, Lysol wipes and hand sanitizer will be difficult to acquire for a lot of people. But overall, I think that there's just a desire on the American people to get over the hump and try to get things back to the way they were in 2019.
Hopefully we will be headed in that direction very, very quickly. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization. We actually looked at our data, and we've got over 500,000 members now throughout the country. We've been growing dramatically over the last year because our members are interested in economic freedom and liberty and first principles surrounding a constitutionally limited government. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website's clubforgrowth.org. You can become a member for free, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll check in with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
An at-home COVID-19 test is about to become available, but getting it won't be easy. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns why from Jeffrey Singer of the Cato Institute.
Well, the best news that we've had, easily the best news that we've had on the COVID-19 front anytime recently, is the announcement a few weeks ago that a vaccine could be ready potentially by the end of the year, or at least by early 2021. But maybe the second best news that we've had is the announcement this week that the FDA has approved an at-home COVID testing kit. But there's a big catch. The FDA is going to require that you get a prescription before you can use it. We're going to talk about that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, and he's a practicing physician as well. And he joins us now on the phone from his car, I believe, right outside of his medical practice in Arizona, where he has, he tells me he's literally just finished rounds with his patients. So he is taking a little bit of time out of his obviously very busy schedule to join us here, and we really appreciate that. Dr. Singer, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Glad to have you here as always. And folks, you can check out Dr. Singer's work, not his medical practice work, but his writing work at the Cato Institute's website at cato.org. Dr. Singer, I wanted to ask you today about this new at-home COVID test that was approved just this week by the FDA. This seems like a big deal. There's a catch, which we'll get to in a minute, but first just outline what this means for people generally.
At first blush, it's great news because, of course, we need to get more testing out there. The only way we're going to be able to control this virus is if we know who is contagious and therefore who needs to be isolated from everybody else. So the more tests we perform, the more we're able to learn that and the more weapons we'll have in fighting this pandemic. So here we have a way now that people don't have to go to a doctor. They could give themselves an at-home test if they are concerned that they may have COVID, or even if they're just curious because so many people are asymptomatic. And it's easy to administer to yourself, and within 30 minutes you can get an answer. So this is actually a terrific advance and should be very helpful.
On the other hand, and I can almost hear it in your voice there, that there's a big but coming. And the but is that the FDA is going to require a prescription for this test.
Right, which makes no sense to me. First of all, it's an at-home test. You don't have to have a prescription for an at-home pregnancy test. People could buy that in any pharmacy. You don't need a prescription for an at-home HIV test. So now we have an at-home COVID test, but you need to get a prescription. So that kind of defeats the whole purpose of it being an at-home test, because that means I got to go to a doctor to get a permission slip in order to go to the store to buy this at-home test. And according to the FDA's own instructions, it says that if I go to the doctor or a clinic or wherever and I get a prescription for this at-home test, I can still take the test myself. The doctor is not necessary to perform the test on me. So then you've taken away any of the convenience that was created by this being an at-home test by making me have to go to a doctor. And, you know, of course, you're also subjecting me to the risk of getting COVID, because if I'm going to go to a clinic or a doctor's office, there could be other people there who are going there because they're concerned they have COVID, and maybe I could be catching it from them. That's the whole advantage of being at home. I don't have to be around people. I could take it in the privacy of my own home. And so you basically are allowing this at-home test to be produced and marketed, whereas at the same time, you're undermining any of the advantages of the at-home.
Yeah, and you're still administering the test to yourself, right? I mean, unless I'm confused about this, you're administering it to yourself at home. So it's not like it requires some kind of special technique or knowledge that only a doctor would have. This is something that you can do literally in your own home, but the FDA is saying, well, no, first you have to go out and get that prescription.
Exactly. So basically you're just saying I need a permission slip, but you're telling me it's at home. I don't have to get a permission slip from a doctor to do an at-home pregnancy test or an at-home HIV test. Why do I need a permission slip from a doctor to do an at-home COVID test? Makes no sense.
We are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Singer, senior fellow at the Cato Institute and a practicing physician in Arizona. Dr. Singer, just about a minute or so left here, but I want to just pull back a bit here and make a broader point if we can. I mean, it seems like this situation with the at-home testing kit is another example of this bigger problem, something we've seen for months now with the FDA and the CDC and how they've handled the pandemic. It seems like sometimes they miss the obvious common sense stuff, like don't require somebody to go to a doctor's office to get a prescription when the whole point of an at-home test is that you can stay home to take it. So I don't know. Why does this keep happening? Maybe that's the easiest way to put it.
I don't know. But for example, the CDC tells us that the reason why this disease is so hard to get under control is because up to 40% of people are not symptomatic, and they don't, so they're not sick, they don't even know they're having it, and they could be spreading it to other people. So now you have this at-home test that if you're just curious, if you're wondering, gee, I don't feel sick at all, but maybe I have it, I don't want to spread it to others, you could test it. But according to the FDA rules, you have to have symptoms in order for the doctor to prescribe it for you. So again, how are we going to be able to address the problem when it's not allowing us to address the problem of all these asymptomatic carriers, because it's requiring you to have symptoms to get the at-home test? And so it's the FDA and the CDC apparently are not on the same page on this one, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense. Personally, just about a week ago, I had contact with someone who ended up a few days later testing positive for COVID. So I had to go out and get a test. And luckily, the hospital right around the corner from where I live had tests available, and it was an easy process, but I still had to leave my house. I didn't have any symptoms, so, and ultimately I was negative, but let's say I had tested positive. That meant I would have had to leave the house, maybe interacted with people unnecessarily when I could have had an at-home test that would obviously have been better, but the FDA is still not really fully leaning into the at-home testing process. You still have to get that prescription. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Dr. Singer, thank you so much for joining us.
That was a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, that is Dr. Jeffrey Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can check out his latest writing there at cato.org at their blog. The headline, "You Don't Need a Prescription for a Pregnancy Test. Why Do You Need One for a COVID Test?" More detail on all of the stuff that we've talked about today in that post. You can check out more of our coverage of the pandemic and of the election and everything else that's going on at Reason.com. And for Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Two seats in the U.S. Senate from Georgia will be decided in an early January runoff election. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says the fate of the entire federal government is at stake.
The Georgia runoff elections for U.S. Senate on January 5th are about much more than whether Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer becomes Senate Majority Leader. Those elections will determine the entire strategy for the Biden administration, at least for its first 2 years. If Republicans win one or both of the two seats, they will keep their Senate majority. And with that majority, they can do two strategically significant things. They can stop all bad legislation proposed by Biden and Pelosi, and they can block any effort to pack the Supreme Court by adding Democrat leading justices who will have an expansive view on what's constitutional and will serve as a rubber stamp for the Biden administration. The partisan situation we will have if Republicans win just one of the two Georgia seats is a Democrat president, a Democrat House of Representatives, and a Republican Senate. The president will promote certain policies, and those policies that become legislation that begins in the House presumably will reflect the president's policies, largely if not totally. But because the Senate Majority Leader is able to fully control what gets taken up by the Senate and what gets shelved and ignored by the Senate, it's perfectly possible for those bills never even to be put on the floor for debate, let alone passage. That's the power that the Senate Majority Leader wields. And that's the power that provides the Majority Leader two distinctly different strategic options. He can stop cold any bill that he opposes, or he can force a negotiation with the President and or the House. Joe Biden never tired of telling anyone who would listen that he had made a career out of reaching across the aisle and seeking compromise. There's even a history of occasional cooperation between McConnell and then-Senator Biden over the 24 years in which both men were senators. The fact that McConnell can prevent a vote or debate from taking place on a bill he doesn't like, even if some Republican senators would vote in favor, certainly sets the table for compromise. He can be a dealmaker, or he can be a stonewall of obstruction. At age 78, he may not run again in 2026 when he'd be 84. That gives him enormous flexibility. On the other hand, if both of the two Democrat challengers in the Georgia U.S. Senate runoff win, then there would be an easy path to one-party dominance of the executive and legislative branches, and the Senate rules could be changed to eliminate the filibuster. Democrats could then ram through any number of left-leaning policies, but it would be even worse than that. With no need for Republican votes, the House and Senate Democrats could pass a bill that the president would sign that would increase the number of Supreme Court justices to any number, most likely 13, thus giving presumptive President Biden four new Democrat-favoring justices. More Supreme Court appointments than any president has had in his first term in over 150 years. If that happened, then there would be one-party rule in all three branches of government, and the framers of our Constitution, who prized their system of separation of powers and checks and balances above all else, they would turn over in their graves. It's quite possible that the balance could never again be restored. That's what's at stake in the Georgia runoffs, the very heart of the Constitution of the United States and our system of government. And if that's not bad enough, they could also pack the Senate by admitting to statehood Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, thus adding four new likely Democrat senators. And finally, they could approve citizenship for up to 20 million immigrants, more than 10 million of whom are of voting age, now here illegally. How do you think those newly amnestied immigrants would vote? I pray there's enough common sense and enough respect for the Constitution in Georgia next January to prevent this existential tragedy from occurring. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Email your comments to me at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at lfrusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KLNG-AM in Omaha, Nebraska, WLMR-AM in Chattanooga, Tennessee, along with WSKY-AM in Asheville, North Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.